pals o' mine, my fellow hikers and campers, outdoor enthusiasts, will appreciate the outdoor wedding I attended earlier this week. It was in the Alabama Hills. Beautiful weather, about 75 degrees. The mountains in the back with Mount Whitney had a bluish tint, and in the foreground were the Alabama Hills themselves with all the reddish rock. Beautiful. A bunch of us had gone down there a few days before so we could camp and go on some hikes. The weather leading up to the wedding was diverse. We had gusty winds. We had torrential rain and we had some snow. We walked along Sabrina Lake for a little fall color to see if we could find some to photograph. And the next day we hiked up to Lone Pine Trail, which is on the Whitney Portal Trail. And it was about 38 to 39 degrees at the lake. Yes, very chilly. But the day of the wedding, 75 degrees. Clear, beautiful. The rain had kept the dust down, so it was perfect. I was reading about Google's self-driving car, which is still in the testing stages, and makes me a little nervous knowing that it might be out there. But I appreciate the effort and the intention of its creation to assist those with disabilities. There are quite a variety of physical and mental challenges people are living with these days, so I talked with Lori Horup, president of the Association of California State Employees with Disabilities and author of I Can Dance, My Life with a Disability, who has a form of muscular dystrophy. So my grade school had an extension to it where it was for special needs kids. Mm-hmm. In fact, I had to go there a few times because I had a lisp. Mm-hmm. So their speech-language expert had to help me with that. In fact, one of my brothers talked like Elmer Fudd. He needed assistance too. But every once in a while, they would integrate some of the students with the regular classes. Mm-hmm. Not very often. But there's two girls. I remember this so clearly. I was maybe second, third grade. And one was Kathy. She had very frizzy hair and leg braces. And the other one was Helen. She was blind and she would just stand there shaking her hands up and down. I don't know who made this decision, why or how, but one of the students decided that it was cool to talk to Helen, but not to Kathy. And I talked to Kathy one time just because I felt bad for her. But I've thought about that off and on over the years, how some people are so influential in their personalities, even in second or third grade, that they can do that. Now, because of that experience, I make a point of not ignoring one or the other. But obviously not everybody has that advantage, should I say. So what was your experience? You was almost 2 years old when you...
Yeah, I was diagnosed at 2. But at that point, they knew very little about the disability. They actually told my mother I probably wouldn't live more than a year. She was separated from my father at the time, decided she didn't want to live without me. Took me home, put me down for a nap, turned on the gas, decided we would both go together, and then luckily after a few minutes thought, what if the doctors are wrong? Turned off the gas, thankfully. Probably wisest decision she made in her life. And by the time I was 5 or 6, I was too active for what they initially thought was wrong. So at that point, they diagnosed me as a form of muscular dystrophy, which most people associate that with Jerry Lewis and the telethon. What a lot of people don't realize is that's just an umbrella term for like 40 different neuromuscular diseases, and I was one of the 40. That age, they kind of told her I wouldn't live probably beyond 9 or 10. 9 or 10, it changed again, and anyhow, that's another story. Getting back to your question, so early on, I was in kindergarten, first grade, I guess, and we didn't have a special ed classroom or school in our little town. We were in a town of like 300. So the nearest school was 40 miles away. So my mom would drive me the 40 miles. This was a self-contained classroom, K-8, one teacher, wow, several aides. Shortly after attending there, my mom began to realize that because I was kindergarten, as was one other child, all that was happening was the aides were playing with us. And so my mom had a cow. She's like, I'm not driving 40 minutes one way so that you can play with her. I can play with her at home. So that was our first trip to the school board, what I often refer to as my first introduction to advocacy. Mm. Because what I remember is sitting in the hallway outside the office and my mother screaming her head off. And the next thing I knew, we had a tutor that was coming to our house. The tutor came after school. So I was home all day with my mom. And then after school, the other kids would be outside playing and everything. And the tutor would be at our house tutoring me. So that went on to about fourth grade, actually. At that time, I would be allowed, I'd get to go to school for parties or picture day. And I don't remember being treated any differently or anything because I kind of was growing up with these kids in the neighborhood. And the town was so small, everybody just looked out after everybody.
That's probably a factor, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I think it was a huge factor. For the same reason, these kids grew up helping me out, taking care of me. The eighth grade girls were kind of had been babysitters. So they knew how to take me to the bathroom or that kind of thing. And so finally, by the end of fourth grade, my fourth grade tutor came to my mom and I one day and said, "Why isn't she in school?" And I think both my mom and I had kind of different feelings. My mom assumed because there was no special ed class, they'd never let it happen. And I assumed I just wasn't allowed. And so finally asked the question. It was like, well, nobody really knew, so it was another trip back to the school board. And then all of a sudden, I was allowed to go to school. With the condition that probably in the coldest months of the year, I would go back to having a tutor because of the risk for my health. Because we lived in Illinois, and the winters got pretty severe. So I started fifth grade with my classmates. I had a desk in the back of the room. Everything was wonderful. They were all helpful. They took turns staying in with me at recess because at that time, there was no ADA, so the school was not accessible. There was steps up into the front. There was one step out the back, if I remember correctly, but no pavement outside by any means. So they stayed in with me, and I would say things were great until about sixth grade. And we had a new girl move in.
Uh-oh.
And she came from a bigger city, and it was almost as though she was a very pretty little girl, and I think she was used to having a lot of attention. And so it kind of became a competition thing in terms of she didn't like sharing. And it's amazing how early we learned that. So at that point, the teasing started, you know, making fun of me, really strange things. And so I went through what I call a year of hell. I hated it. I didn't want to go to school. And what was really interesting is most of the kids who had turned on me, on rare occasion, they would kind of turn on somebody else. And I remember going to school one morning, this one little girl was in the bathroom crying because the other kids were teasing her. And boy, my mom went into that bathroom and lined up all those little girls and really gave them hell for what they were doing. And I kind of just sat back and watched her because I had gone home to her many days in tears. And she would always say to me, "Well, you know, you got to figure this out. This is something you're going to have to deal with, so learn how to handle it." So here she is defending this other little girl, and again, when we got home, I was like, well, how come when it happened to Marion, you know, you yelled at everybody, but when it's me, you don't say anything? And she said, because this isn't something Marion's going to have to deal with her whole life.
Good
and
point.
You are. Whether I understood that
at the time.
At the time, in fifth or sixth grade, or sixth grade, I guess. Probably not, but I think I grew to understand it. I remember another child in same grade getting teased. That we lived in farm country, and they lived on a farm with no running water. It was a pig farm, and those kids had to get up at the crack of dawn to do the farming. They'd come to school. They would smell. Nobody wanted to anything to do with that little girl. And I remember being kind of torn, actually. Part of me, because of having experienced it myself, wanted to be very compassionate and understanding. But then the other part of wanting to be accepted by the others, I knew that was just going to be one more point against me if I was her friend. So it does. It happens.
It happened to me as well.
Yeah.
I had glasses. My friend had braces. And In fact, at one point, she said we were in high school. You know, she said we should, because we noticed that the pretty girls didn't need to have personalities.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided that our children were going to be really interesting because their mothers had had braces and glasses.
There you go.
But most of my life, even adult life, being blonde, blue-eyed, blonde, dumb
right.
blonde,
mm-hmm.
assuming that I have a very low IQ, and the shock on their faces when I would actually have a firm handshake. to this day, even though it's obviously not to the extent that you were treated or your challenges, I too, being the receiving end of it, am more compassionate when I see somebody who's on the receiving end and I'm the bulldog and standing up in front of them. And
well, yeah, the coping thing of what you said about the different groups, I remember for me, I think it was sometime between 7th and 8th grade, I think everybody started to grow up a little bit and mature. And with that happening, as well as my mom kind of took it upon herself. My mom was always one, if I couldn't go to it, she'd try to bring it to me. And so I remember her volunteering to be like the coach or the cheerleader mom. So what that meant is, even though I wasn't cheerleading, I was part of that group because I was going to all of the events and I was part of the practices. And so she had me fit in, and because she wouldn't tolerate anybody teasing or bullying anybody else, that kind of went out the window. And then by high school, I didn't belong to any one clique, but I had friends in every one of them. So whether it was the, you know, the jocks, the cheerleaders, the stoners, the really smart nerds, I mean, whatever, you know, title you want to give them, I had friends in all of them, which meant I was accepted by each group. And so that, I think, was my strategy for the acceptance piece. And not being so different, you know, from everybody else.
Well played.
Mm-hmm. Not consciously, I don't think, but still done, yeah.
So high school, that's another different...
That's a whole other beast.
Yes, it is.
Again, small town, high school, no special ed. However, our high school had a freight elevator. And it was that freight elevator that made it accessible to me to get to my classes upstairs and downstairs.
Interesting.
By the time I got to high school, whereas when I was younger, the older girls were doing my care and taking me to the restroom from babysitting, by the time I got to high school, my friends were all doing it. It was just a fact that if I wanted to be able to go to a slumber party, or if I wanted to go somewhere or spend the night, obviously I could not have my mom at my side to do all those things. So initially, it kind of started as my friends' moms would step in and help a little bit, maybe if the caring, if they weren't strong enough. But generally, from, I would say, 8th grade on, my friends were carrying me, they were helping me with the restroom, they were showering me, putting me on a bar stool or a chair in the shower. We all figured out a way. And so I would say I probably had an immediate group of friends, 6 or 7 of them, that all could do all of those things. And so by the time I got to high school, they were all there because we all went to the same school. And you know how you all have in a different elementary school? And then by high school, you kind of all blend, and it's several elementary schools. So ours was 3 elementary schools coming together. And it's kind of interesting because a lot of my friends from my elementary school, our classes at the time were rated A, B, and C. A were kind of exceptional, you know, high Q, did well, whatever, straight A students. B was average, and C was your slower learners or delayed. Pretty much everybody from my school kind of fell into the B group. There was a couple of us that fell into the A group. And the one grade school that we joined with had a whole lot of kids in the A group. So all of a sudden, I was interjected into this whole new realm of people that I wasn't familiar with. So I think my freshman year, that was a little bit challenging. But I think they slowly began to learn and see my other friends. So that by my sophomore year, there was no longer a differentiation on how I was
no longer
treated.
An issue.
Mm-hmm. And I would say the only areas it was when you look at dating or dances. I remember freshman year we had homecoming. Nobody asked me. And so a friend of a friend took me to homecoming. A lot of times I had a crush on a guy from a different school. That made it more acceptable because I didn't see him a lot. By my junior year, my junior prom, it was still kind of, boys at that point were dancing with me at school dances. I would get, you know, asked to dance or whatever. But junior prom, again, it was a friend of a friend who took me. I would dance in the wheelchair from the waist up, yeah. As a matter of fact, 7th grade was my very first dance. And my mother picked me up. I was in the bathroom crying because nobody would dance with me. And I remember her saying, "Miss, at this age, boys have trouble dancing with any girl, let alone one that can't stand up and dance normally." She said, "It'll just take one boy to break the ice." And I think it was our very next dance, which was like a month or so later, and my girlfriend's brother asked me to dance. Now, I don't know whether she paid him, threatened him. I don't know what the story was. It doesn't really matter. But he danced with me. And once he did, the other boys followed suit. And so all of a sudden, dancing wasn't such an issue. It was more of a dating thing. So junior year, nobody asked me. I took a friend of a friend. And it was kind of cute because everybody was going to an after-hours party. And I didn't get invited to any. And then all of a sudden, I showed up at prom. And my date was in uniform. He'd come back from, he'd done the Vietnam War thing. So where everybody was with juniors and seniors who were in their tuxes, I was with the older guy in the uniform. And all of a sudden, we were being invited right and left to after parties. And it was kind of interesting because he would just look at them and say, "Oh, we're really sorry, but we've made other plans."
Nice.
And so he really boosted my ego. He was good for me. And once we got through that dilemma, I think I did go steady my senior year. And so each time there was a crisis of sorts, somehow it just kind of got worked through. I was actually really confident in myself. I mean, my mother raised me to, you can do anything. She raised me to be a risk taker. I remember using the disability to my advantage. I'd be in a car full of folks, and if there was a boy that I liked or had a crush on, you know, I'd tell him, "I need you to put your arm around me to support me so I don't slip if I turn the corner." Or I'd have to reach out and hold on to his thigh so I didn't fall, you know.
Look at you.
Yeah, so I definitely played it. I worked it, exactly, so.
Now, what was your first job?
Oh, God, my first job. You want to talk real job? You know, I went through college, didn't work, got married, had my kids, went back, got my master's degree.
In?
Rehab counseling. My bachelor's was in communication disorders. Still no real employment from either one. When my kids were finally old enough to start school, I was really worried about them getting teased about having a mom in a wheelchair. So I was like, how am I going to nip this one in the bud? Well, I found that by going to school with them early on and meeting the kids and letting the kids ask their questions and do whatever, now I wasn't such the odd thing. Now I was kind of the cool thing. And so,
like Helen on the playground.
Yeah, exactly. So it really benefited my kids, I guess you could say. All of a sudden, I had kids, you know, around me all the time. And so it was at that point that I was volunteering in their classrooms, and I had teachers say to me, "God, you're so good with the kids, and they just respond to you, and you don't always have to show them. They actually have to listen and hear what you're saying, and you should be a teacher." So that kind of guided me into getting my teaching credential. Didn't get work, again, not being accepted, and this time it was older people, it was the administration. Finally, I was volunteering or working with an independent living center, which is a place that provides services to people with disabilities to assist them in living independently. So it's not a residential facility or anything. So I was just on an advisory committee. And then I got hired there as a program manager. I was 45 years old, my first full-time position.
Late bloomer.
Tell me. Then within 9-10 months, the director was leaving and recommended that I become interim. And 3 months later, I was appointed by the board. So I figure within 11 months and 12 months, I was the executive director. And then I did that for 3 years. And then I was appointed by Governor Schwarzenegger as a deputy director for the State Council on Developmental Disabilities. I did that for 2 years, and then I got promoted to chief deputy director, and I did that for 3 more years, and at that point, I was almost 55, and my health took a nosedive. The job was very demanding. I was putting in long hours. I was in the office from 8 to 5, which are typical hours for most, but then I was coming home and working on my computer till 10, 11. I was working weekends, and then our director left, so I became interim executive director. My other deputies were gone. I was the only signing authority in the office. It just eventually took its toll.
Hit your ceiling.
Hit my ceiling. And then I had to make a decision. It was like kind of my life or my career. And it was heartbreaking. I started kind of into a nosedive depression. But thankfully, it was short-lived, and it was kind of finally, okay, Lori, stop this. You've dealt with things your whole life, and people would kill to retire at 55, so just get over it and live life. So it was kind of like, well, what do retired people do? Well, they travel. I like to travel. And so then I just kind of changed my mindset. During that time, I was writing the book, and had just was in the process of getting published. And while I was planning to do some travel, my first thought was, well, I'll go back to the Midwest and visit friends and family. We haven't been there for quite some time. Then it dawned on me that I had no time constraints. So I really didn't have to rush home because vacation was up. So I started thinking more in terms of what are some things I want to do that I haven't done, kind of a bucket list. So my retirement vacation kind of transitioned into a bucket list. And then one of my author friends, right up on the point that I got published, was saying, you realize that if you promote the book along the way, it can become a write-off. And so now my bucket list kind of metamorphosized into a book tour. Having come from the Independent Living Center as a previous career, what I did is I knew they were located all over the country. So I kind of picked all the places I wanted to go, and then I made contact with the ILCs to see if they would give me a place to speak and an audience, and then I would do it for free as long as I had the option of selling the book. And for those places where I didn't have an ILC to go to, I also started contacting support groups for my disability.
Now, all these people that you meet that are disabled, what have you found that they're most surprised at when talking to you?
You know, I think the way I approach the speaking is that I like to explain to people that we all have a story. Mine is one in a million. And each and every one of us, disability or not, has dealt with something throughout our life, some type of crisis, tragedy, that somebody else can learn from. They could use us as a resource. How did we do it? How did we pull through? And so in my speaking, I would tell people, you know, your story can assist somebody else. And if you're not a good writer, then tell it to somebody else and have them put it in writing for you. And I pointed out that if everybody did that, and let's say every ILC for the people I talked to, they each even wrote a short story about one incident and put it all together into a resource manual, how incredible that would be for everyone in their community. So I think the thing that most of them came away with, because then all of a sudden they were telling me their stories. And so I just try to emphasize and support them in that, you know, you've got something worthwhile about you. Share it. I mean, be supportive for somebody else. And I guess for me, I always come away with things of, look at what you have that's good rather than having to always look at how unlucky or how poor me. And so that's really what I push to them.
You were recently elected as president of the Association of California
State Employees with Disabilities.
Thank you. It was ACSED, a long one.
Yeah, ACSED, we refer to it.
Now, do you communicate with other states and exchange resources and ideas?
No.
Or do you find that they are as represented as California is?
I'm not sure exactly what other kinds of groups other states have. ACSED was started, I believe, in the 80s, maybe before then. I don't even know the beginnings of it. I became involved when I first got employed by the state, which was in 06. You know, it's a group of people that just want to better the hiring, retaining, and promoting of people with disabilities in state service. So a good majority of us are retired from the state, but we still have several folks that are employed. And we really kind of try to just get things passed, whether it's through like CalHR or SPB, the State Personnel Board, ways to ensure that things are being done right and assisting folks to get into state service, stay there. We work a lot on reasonable accommodation. We're kind of like an advising group to CalHR, SPB, and We work a lot on trying to get policy implemented to make changes. Well, there's the CME project, which is California as a Model Employment Entity. And so we worked closely with them. And so some of the recommendations that we made have been put into place, but we continue to push because not all of our recommendations have kind of been welcomed with open arms. Presently, there's a program with the state called LEAP, which is Limited Employment Something Program. God, I can't even think of what that stands for. It's terrible. You get to use acronyms for so long and then you forget the words. But it's basically a program that allows people with significant disabilities to get into the state without doing the typical process that most of us have to do. And so you can come in, it's like an examination period where instead of coming in and doing the exam, you get to come in and it's kind of like on the job learning and you see how you do. And it takes longer to become a full-fledged employee, but it's got its merits. That's a program that actually a lot of folks with disabilities don't like because it segregates. And
that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, it kind of gives you that quote-unquote special category. And it's really only in very few entry-level classifications at this point. So it's not that we want to see it go away, but we want to see it enhanced to where it's at all classifications. It's not just entry-level. So that's something we're working on. We also started this awards called the ACES Awards, and we started that a couple years ago, and it's kind of where we look at the various departments, and we honor or give them credit. They get an award for their numbers being up there in terms of hiring people with disabilities. So it brings recognition, and so that's a good thing.
So what do you think about, I'm not going to mention his name because I don't want to promote him, who sues because he can, all these restaurants and businesses that aren't ADA compliant because the building and the location were built,
right,
you know, say 50 years ago. Now they're out of business. And
you know, there's two ways you can look at this. First of all, I'm not a sue happy person. And I have been to a great number of places that are not accessible. And my course of action, preferably, is to either bring it to the attention of management, owner, whatever, and see if changes can be made. Do I believe in drive-by suing? Absolutely not. I think it gives people with disabilities a bad name, and it's like, oh, there's so few of you, da-da-da. However, as much as I condemn what the person you're referring to is doing, the other side of that is the ADA has been around for almost 25 years. We still have businesses and places that are totally non-accessible that aren't compliant with that law. If you were to take a person that was an African American and they couldn't get into a building or were denied services because of access, that would be a huge stink in America. It would never be tolerated in this day and age. And one of the stories that you always hear back was, well, we just don't have that many people with disabilities come here, so it's not worth our while. Well, if you're not accessible, you're not going to have that many people with disabilities coming there. So
catch 22.
Yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, I understand about historic that, you know, the building's been around for 50 years. And you know what? Truth be told, they've got a thing that's called readily achievable. And all that you really are demanded to do when you're in that scenario of old building, historic or whatever, you either have to have maybe a parking space, which we're talking a can of blue paint with a few stripes, maybe a ramp, at least up to the front door. We're talking a bag of concrete to make a small, you know, ramp up a curb. Those are not going to make or break anybody. Putting in an elevator? Yeah, that could be pretty costly. Having to restructure your whole building? Yes, pretty costly. But that's generally not what the law requires. And so you've got buildings that are newly created that either haven't been investigated by code or whatever. But, you know, I think for the most case, everything new and upcoming is built according to code. And the others that are not, I don't know that they're required to do as much as they say. There was a restaurant a couple years ago, very tiny. People who could walk could barely get in. And someone with a disability, I guess, sued. Now, you could say that poor person, they had to close down their business and they had to move. That person now has four restaurants in four different areas and is rolling in the big bucks. And I guarantee you a big part of it came from all the publicity that came out of this one little story, had he still been in his little corner of the world with nobody bringing attention to him, I don't think the growth would have been there. So I'm just saying...
Yes, but I wouldn't... That's pushing the envelope to say that automatically if somebody's put out of business, they're going to become
wealthy. Right, no, but I'm just saying there's two sides to look at.
No, I understand that, but let's not say across the board that's going to happen for everybody. Yeah. In that one case, he was... Mm-hmm. He was very fortunate.
Yes, very fortunate.
But most of them, because of attorney's fees, they're wiped out. Mm-hmm. And they are not able to do that. Mm-hmm. But, obviously, it needs to be addressed. And let's go on the other end of the spectrum, away from buildings and to parks, where you would like to recreate, like everyone else.
Right.
As my listeners know, I highlight national parks every week. So I know there are places that it's an issue. Other places have been accommodating. I've noticed trails that are wheelchair-accessible trails, which is fabulous.
Right.
So any places that you've come across that were frustrating to you?
You know, I tend to think more in terms of the parks that have been accessible as being wonderful. I don't know that I focus too much on the ones that I can't get to as much as I focus on the ones that I can.
I just wondered if you had hoped to get in a particular one. And
you know, not at this point. I mean, I have to say, I love the Golden Access Pass, which is called something else now, I think. But that gets me into a lot of the national parks free, gives us some great discounts. I mean, so we've been accommodated that way to a really good deal for a couple summers in a row. When my kids were young, we lived in the desert. We stayed there in the summer. It was so hot, we were like all trapped in the house, which made me crazy. So we started going to camping for the summer. And because of the discounted fee, the cost for us was almost comparable to what we would have paid for our air conditioning had we let it run all summer. You know, I think there's been some great strides. I've also been to state parks that, you know, a lot of them have been great. There's this new one up in Grass Valley. I'm not sure if it's state or national, but now it's been made accessible, the trail.
Which one is that?
And you know what? I'm going to have to look it up and send you the...
I'm just curious. I know there's a butterfly... Independence Trail is what I'm thinking.
That's it.
But that's not recent. That's been a few
years. No, but it's better now, I guess. They've done some stuff. I mean,
they improved it?
Yeah, I saw the article in the paper. A friend of mine actually sent it to me. I said, oh, we have to go try this out. And so we did. And we only walked probably half of it. But it was good. And it was really neat that we could get back in there and do that. And yeah, it wasn't paved. I mean, it's not like it was a paved pathway.
But you can get some pretty solid... dirt.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. As long as it's solid dirt and not gravel, right. I mean, generally you can manage. We were just, my husband and I went to Reno a couple days ago, and I heard about this animal rescue place up there called Animals Ark. Had it not been for the smoke, I could give you a better report, because we decided not to do it because the smoke was so thick. But we want to go up and check it out. And I believe their trails are kind of like heavy packed dirt, and but that's not a state park or national park. But anyway,
yeah, the kids must love the camping.
Yes, they did. We actually had a system down. We would leave the day after school got out, head up there, and you were only allowed to stay in the parks 2 weeks at a time, and then you had to be out for 2 weeks, and you could only stay a maximum of like 30 days in a calendar year. So what we did is we had our two favorite parks, one on each side of the lake. And so we would come into one, and each of the kids had their own tent, and they each got one of the Labradors to sleep with so they weren't alone or afraid. And we had a little tent camper, and then we did the whole, you know, we had our little kitchen area set up, we'd bring up the barbecue, and we'd be there for 2 weeks, and then we would kind of just fold everything in. We wouldn't actually unpack or repack, and then we'd move to the other side of the lake and do our 2 weeks. And then we would come back. And so a good 2 months we were camping straight. And because we were there for so long, and most people only come for a weekend or a week, we fished all the time, so we would give people our extra fish. So when they would leave, they'd give us all their extras that, you know, they want, whether it be a watermelon or their firewood or whatever. So
see, that's how it should be.
Oh, you know, I have to say, you know how when you grow up, and people say, what do you remember most from your childhood? Or what's, you know, to this day, if you ask either of my kids, they will tell you their time in Big Bear. It was a time where we didn't have computers to use, we didn't have cell phones, we did have a pager at the time that we had for an emergency. But, you know, every day we would find an activity to do during the heat of the day. We would sit and read, so we all went to the library once a week. Evening time was spent as family, playing games, fishing, sitting around the campfire.
Quality.
Quality. It was such incredible quality time with them. After the kids grew up, we kind of progressed, and we actually bought a travel trailer, and we widened the doorway, and we made it, he cut out one of the tables and made it accessible, and we did that for several years. Now we're to the point that's still a lot of work on him. He's got to set it all up, he's got to take it all down, and handle me in a very cramped quarters. We've talked about maybe getting a motorhome, you know, that we're reaching that point of let's get a motorhome and maybe travel. But yeah, so we haven't actually, I'd say we haven't camped for probably 2 years, so it's been a while. But there's, like I said, the reasons behind it. He's not as young as he used to be, so lifting me off a cot in a tent, it's not an easy thing to do, and all the things that we did when we were younger aren't quite the same now.
Yeah, you have to get more creative.
Exactly, that's what we have to do.
And your grandkids, the numbers are growing, I understand.
Mm-hmm, I have 3 grandsons right now, and another one on the way. So
boys. Surrounded by boys.
I've warned my daughter. My son and daughter-in-law have 2 boys, 6 and 2, and they're done. And so my daughter and son-in-law have 1 son, and they're the ones having the second one here. So I got to be in the delivery room with her when she had her first.
Oh, nice.
And so I get to do it again. And I warned her. I said, if this one comes out a boy, I'm putting it right back up there, and you are going to try again. So we've been razzing on. It's like, I want a granddaughter. So, of course, we're going to love him, whatever he is.
Well, of course.
But it would be nice to have a granddaughter.
But speaking of kids, you were telling me earlier that you're writing another book that's focused specifically for children, that's written for them, for their level, that's not as blunt as I Can Dance. Is that correct?
Yes. This book, because it truly is my life story, I'm very candid about most aspects of my life, and that includes sexuality. So that's addressed in my memoir. It's certainly not porn by any means, but it's pretty, like I said, pretty blunt.
It's on the table. It's a bullet point in the life of.
Exactly. And, you know, it's kind of like one of those things that people have questions about but are afraid to ask or embarrassed to ask. So I've always been one to just kind of hit things head on. So in doing this book, though, and having it published, one of my publisher's concerns was he couldn't market it to the school system. So I got to thinking about that and decided, you know, I need to have one that's at a little bit lesser level. So what I did, even though I say it's fiction, it's kind of on the cusp of fiction, nonfiction, I took my 5th through 8th grade years and just expounded on that. So the story's about a little girl who first starts going to school in 5th grade, and then it's everything she experiences through those 4 years, you know, friends, bullying, growing up, what she learns from her peers, what her peers learn from her, and then it ends at her 8th grade graduation. Hopefully, I'm figuring by spring. This one actually came out on my birthday, so I'm thinking maybe the next one will come out on my birthday, too. Maybe I'll make that my tradition. This one was submitted to my first writing competition. I won first place on it, and that was very cool, a nonfiction general category. And now I've got an option of going 2 different ways. I really want to write a sequel to my memoir. Basically, my memoir is about living, you know, my life with a disability, but I was still employed when I ended this book. Now that I'm retired and I'm getting older, I'm realizing that as many resources that there are out there for people who are seniors, when you throw a disability into the mix, there's really a lot of gaps. And so I would like to write a book called, since this one's called I Can Dance, I want to write one that says from a fast dance to a slow shuffle, aging with a disability. And then kind of write my later years and some of the experiences I've had and how I've dealt with them. So I would like to do that, but then now that my kids' book ended at 8th grade, somebody said, now you should take it up a step and maybe do high school or even break high school. Because I did high school pretty, you know, chapter for each year in my memoir, but if I were to take each year and really
expand
and delve into what really happened each of those years, then I could have a series for my kids' book too. So
You gotta combat all those vampire books.
Yeah, I know, exactly. That's what I'm thinking. So, yeah, my kid's book at this point, which, of course, you never know, the title may change based on your publisher, but right now I'm calling it It's Okay to Be Different.
Mm-hmm. Have you kept in contact with the kids from your grade school and high school?
Oh, yeah. It's kind of funny. You grow up in a small town, and we may not be in touch for a few months, but Facebook, of course, has made that much easier. But even when there wasn't a Facebook, we might not talk for months, but then give us a week to catch up on things, or a couple days, I mean, to catch up on things. And it was like we were never apart. So I'd say of my close circle, I talk to each of them on a fairly regular basis, and many of them have been here. So,
and how many of you out there can say that?
If you're looking for a disability mentor or just someone with whom to contact, you can visit her website at lauriselegacy.com. And Lori is spelled L-A-U-R-I-E, lauriselegacy.com. As you know, each show I highlight a different national park. This week, however, I'm going to lead you on a little offshoot trail to give a shout out to the Wilderness Society's efforts and accomplishments, such as last week's unveiling of its project in Idaho, making the Bruno Canyon Overlook safer and more accessible to people with disabilities. In June, in celebration of the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, the Wilderness Society and the 21st Century Conservation Corps launched 50 conservation projects. The 50 for the 50th projects will build and restore miles of trails, clear habitat of invasive species, make acres of local green spaces more accessible for communities, and engage scores of young people and veterans in protecting America's greatest treasures. Their projects include the Devil's Backbone Trail in the Angeles National Forest in California, Turkey Pen Gap in Tennessee, and Whitefish Trail in the Flathead National Forest in Montana. Sometimes wild places are close to or within our city limits, so projects will also include Candlestick Point State Park Restoration in San Francisco, and Bladensburg Waterfront Park, near Washington, D.C. If you have teenagers, this would be a great introduction to community service for school assignments. Do something different. Learn a historical fact about your birthplace.